Interesting, over the years, and I'm going to hand this off to you. Over the years, I have been asked to pray simultaneously with others before. My great uncle pastored a small backwoods Baptist church where they used to pray simultaneously. And then I was at a Korean service years ago where I was invited to pray simultaneously. And I know lots of different churches globally do that. And I'm just always way more comfortable just listening to somebody pray. And I want to know why that is in myself. And I also want to know why different people have done that in different ways over time. If you know where I can find a source for why that difference has come up over time, why some people like to listen or silence, and some people like bombastic, loud, even simultaneous prayers, would love any insight to that and how that difference came about, because you can kind of see the virtues and the benefits of both. If you will stand with me, I'm going to read from Revelation chapter 3, verses 14 till the end of the chapter, because the majority of my recap sermon is going to allude back to this particular passage. It says this, "To the angel of the church in Laodicea write, these are the words of the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the ruler of God's creation. I know your deeds, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were either one or the other. So, because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I am about to spit you out of my mouth. You say, I am rich, I have acquired wealth, and do not need a thing. But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, so you can become rich, and white clothes to wear, so you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put on your eyes so you can see. Those whom I love, I rebuke and discipline. So be earnest and repent. Here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person, and they with me. To the one who is victorious, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I was victorious and sat down with my Father on his throne. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. You may be seated." It's never good to have a pastor use the pulpit as a confessional booth. However, I must offer at least an admission that along the way, while preaching and preparing sermons for the book of Revelation, it was easy for me to wonder, how do I bring the truth or the challenge of this passage to bear on the lives of the congregation of Agape Chicago? There was a struggle that I felt, losing sight of the big picture, and even as I will show you today, how dynamically Revelation speaks to Christians facing various challenges. And to help you kind of make sense of that, I'm going to detail the future visions of two different 20th century books, and kind of tell you about how their visions of the future, being starkly different, affect how I read our culture, our situation and time, and therefore also how I preach the book of Revelation. Those two books are 1984, as you know, and then Brave New World. Now, 1984, written by George Orwell, and Brave New World, written by his professor and teacher, Aldous Huxley. First, I want to talk about 1984. Many of you maybe have read that book before, maybe you read it in high school or some other time. And that book tells us about a world where most pleasures and differences and exciting things, even romance, is forbidden by an extremely strict surveillance state. And that book is where the term Big Brother came into our common speech, our common parlance. That, again, was that ability for the state to watch every action people were doing. Big Brother is watching you. And that famous web of spy cameras and thought police would send shivers down the spine of any reader that took this potential future seriously. And if 1984 is where we're heading, then it would be easy for me to jive the central part of the book, especially with the Antichrist and the Beast, with 1984, and go with that. But in A Brave New World, there's a quite different vision for the future. In that future, you don't have a strong surveillance state. You don't have this kind of tyrannical leadership. In fact, in that novel, pleasure abounds everywhere, and everyone takes a daily drug called Soma that excites their pleasure sensations, and it sedates them from any negative experiences, the feelings of pain, or any sort of discomfort whatsoever. And people are taught to not let themselves experience any unpleasant sensations. Like in the movie WALL-E, humans in a Brave New World become dependent on amusements, machines, and even that drug to keep them in a stupor, unable to experience anything difficult. And in that way, they are kept in control. And the way I read our culture today, the United States of America, especially urban culture, is I believe that we're closer to a brave new world in the 21st century than having to face Big Brother. The big tech does change that dynamic a little bit in my mind. And as much as we fear fascism, communism, or any other ism that strikes fear in us, that our freedoms might be taken away from some domineering force from the outside, I see currently more of us freely giving away our freedoms to endless entertainment, circuses, and parades, if you will. I see us currently living in a decadent society that we're glad to embrace and not worry too much about pain and the like. I believe, again, I didn't get all this stuff myself, by the way, and I'm borrowing a lot of this stuff ultimately from a guy named Neil Postman, who argued in a famous book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, that we're so numbed by our pleasures that we have little strength within ourselves to offer genuine Christian resistance to the world as it is. And if I'm right, then it would seem Revelation, with its cycles of judgments, the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, the dragon looking to devour a woman, a beast that is expressing his oppression to the nations along with his false prophet. It was easy for me at times to think, man, how does this speak to us? I don't feel like we're there just yet. I feel like whatever this is showing us, it's in the future. It's not today. It's not immediate. Now, again, it's possible to combine the 1984 and Brave New World ideas where we are in a stupor that is being surveyed. I get that. But you see the rub I had, the difficulty I had addressing us sometimes. And again, Revelation was speaking to an incredibly persecuted church, telling us about a time where we would face great persecution. All the while I don't feel like we're kind of right there just yet, though we may be heading in that direction. And how does this book speak to that? It was part of the struggle I faced. So what I wanted to realize, what I was struggling to realize as I came through the book of Revelation, is that I was trying to put into words the fact that I think many of us might be just too comfortable to want to be made uncomfortable by the book of Revelation. And so I had to really work hard at helping us see that fact. You see, why would we want to be uncomfortable with the message of this book, given the fact that things aren't so bad right now in many ways for many of us? And what I want to do today is I summarize the book of Revelation in retrospect, as I want to own those mistakes a little bit, but I also want to build on the last two messages that I heard and recognize that the book of Revelation promises us blessings if we'll listen. That was something we heard from Hugh's message last week, and I'll read a passage from that. And I also want to build on Grant's message 2 weeks ago, which emphasized the images that are found in the book of Revelation. I believe that if we were to take anything away from the book of Revelation, I want us to take away the images, especially that warn us and invite us. But first, let me read again a blessing from this book so that you remember that we did this for a reason. I want you to be blessed. I want to be blessed. Let's be blessed. And let's figure out how that blessing comes together. Revelation 1:3 says this, Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. I believe this blessing is true. This book promises it for us. And so part of my job is to consider, how is God blessing you and me through this book? How is this blessing meant to come? And again, I think that the images that the book of Revelation is supposed to inspire within our imagination. You see, image and imagination go together in both thought and in both word, and also in the way that they actually work. And when we think about dragons and beasts and prostitutes and brides and even visions of Christ himself, Revelation is supposed to stick with us and challenge the way that we see the world. So what I want to do today is I want to help us see these images, how they challenge the church, and challenge us to see that Revelation offers us both warnings and invitations. And so I'm going to give you images that warn and images that invite. And that's going to be how I recap this. First, I want to offer two images that warn. Image number one, the wealthy as poor. The wealthy as poor. So if we're comfortable, if we're doing all right, if we're doing well, be careful, because we might just be poor in the end, the book of Revelation teaches us. Recall that Revelation begins with an image of Jesus amongst seven lampstands. And those seven lampstands, these are representative of the churches that he is addressing. And many of those churches are persecuted, they're poor, they're marginalized, they're having to work through the difficulties of engaging idolatrous neighbors and the businesses that are engaged in, the businesses related to the idolatry around them. And today, there's a church that is being addressed that I really want to focus on, that has uniquely become wealthy, due especially to the fact that they have a famous clothing that comes from the black wool that's around them, and an ISAM, that's the Church of Laodicea, that we read about earlier. And in a hint of irony, not even a hint, in a declaration of irony, this is what Jesus says to this particular church. He says to them, "You say, 'I am rich, I have acquired wealth, and do not need a thing.' But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire so you can become rich, and white clothes to wear so you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put on your eyes so you can see." These descriptions hit home for that original audience. The wealthy among them are actually poor. Those who have amassed large fortunes through selling clothing are naked. Those who are rich through selling a salve for the eyes are in fact blind. And it drives home the essential point that the affluent of all ages and all times need to hear. That is this. The very thing that makes you feel most comfortable might be the thing that puts you in greatest danger. It might be the thing that you're building your life upon that will cause your greatest fall. And it might be the temporary comforts that you are unwilling to give up that can leave you eternally distant from the embrace of the God you were made for. And we need to hear that over and over again, but these images of someone who is clothed and wearing gold jewelry and having all that they could possibly need, actually being destitute, drives home the point to us, are you in fact poor or feeling rich? Let me reiterate another point that's connected to some of my struggles that I had along the way. Because at the end of the day, we do have to recognize the book of Revelation teaches trouble is coming. And what happens when that trouble comes for a comfortable, a complacent, a people that are unwilling to resist the world? What are we going to do when the Antichrist comes along? If you aren't willing to get uncomfortable a little bit for Christ, the specter of persecution is going to be a hard challenge, a hard task to address indeed. You see, even when such persecution isn't present at the current moment, you are either being prepared to be someone who can stand in the face of hardship, or you're not someone who can stand when the siren song comes along and says, just play it safe, just go along with everyone else, you will be okay. And we can easily, even in the times where we are not being actively persecuted to the degree that we will face one day, We can be blind to the fact that we live in a culture where our self-destruction becomes imminent, not because of the things that are being done to us from the outside, but because of how we let our soul rot from the inside. Christians are shaped by our current culture just like anyone else. We are shaped through our smartphones, we are shaped through our educational systems, we are shaped by our marketplaces and the businesses where we work. And all of these places emphasize perpetual consumption, the acquisition of wealth at all costs, and the belief that there really is no other way to live this life. We imagine that being gluttonous in our spending and hoarding large amounts of cash piles isn't just the way that we should live. It's the only responsible way to be. The book of Revelation tells us yet again that it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. And it shows us through powerful imagery the danger if we are trusting in earthly riches to keep us safe. And in fact, we may be in grave danger. We may be destitute and poor at the end of the day. Image number two that warns is worldliness as engaging a prostitute. Now, this is a little similar, but a little different in some ways. In the middle of Revelation, there are these cycles of judgments that I've just mentioned. And there we meet the characters that Revelation is really known for: the dragon, who is Satan, the sea beast, who is the Antichrist, and the land beast, who is the false prophet. Then the judgment commences against all these characters and those who followed them by taking on the number 666. And this is the stuff that everybody knows about from Revelation, even if you've never read the book much. It's, again, the stuff of 1984. Powerful rulers dominate, coerce, manipulate, keep everybody in check through some sort of global system. However, in the middle of these visions, John is introduced to another character in Revelation 17, 1 through 2. And it says this, it shows us this character. In fact, it's again a vision. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitutes who sits by many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Now, there are two aspects of this imagery that stands out for most biblical scholars. This woman is described as sitting by many waters. And waters were the places where trade routes existed, where people were going to sell something via ship. This is where they would go and sell their wares and all their goods. And the kings here are being described as committing adultery with her, suggests that she is clearly distinct from the military and the political rule of these kings. That is, the kings are the military political rule, and she is something else, something related to wealth. To drive the point home, Revelation 17, 4 through 5 says this: "The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries." This woman is wealthy. She has jewelry. She has fine clothes. We are told that she likes to drink the blood of martyrs elsewhere. And she is against God's people in so many ways. And she is identified also as Babylon. That is a code word for the city of Rome. Again, focusing on the military, the political aspects of the Roman machine. She, this prostitute, is the economic system of Rome. It's backward ways of handling business with the kings and the rulers of this earth. And the idea is that, and to cozy up with her and to be comfortable with her and her way of being, often, again, involved with idolatrous practices then and even today, is to, in some ways, be okay with relations with the prostitute. And to hear this image in its original context, with its original meaning, was to call into question the way that people relate to marketplaces, the exchanges of goods, services, money, and also anything that's not necessarily related to merely brute power through politics or force. Anything that can fill one's pockets. This is what is potentially influenced by this prostitute. And this image provokes in us a desire to reflect on our relations to our personal business, our acquisitions, our hoarding of wealth, in spite and instead of hospitality, generosity, or lack thereof. It's a way of looking at our world and seeing all the different ways that it's possible to be enmeshed in worldliness and to refuse to call into question, even in the face of the evidence that we live in a broken, terrible, wicked, anti-God sort of time. This past week, I was reading an opinion piece that was written by somebody outside of the New York Times about how gambling has changed sports. Super interesting to me. And what he called the casinification of sports hits home, does it not? If you like sports, you know that in this day and age, if you pay attention to any game or whatever, people are always talking about bets on that game. But in that same article, he even, as he lamented in his own way, without the adequate tools to lament moral decay, he talked about all sorts of ironies that he was seeing in light of that. He was seeing that not only now are sports places where people are constantly betting on this or that, but he was walking in downtown Times Square, and he saw one of the marquees betting odds for how much the difference would be in the mayor elections, what the differences would be in the mayor elections in New York City. And he pointed out how ridiculous and how ironic so much of American life is. You see, many Americans are financially concerned about the price of eggs increasing by a dollar here, a dollar there, while on the other side of the aisle, so many people don't mind flushing a few hundred dollars away because they were wrong about how much the popular vote difference was between Cuomo and Mondani, however you pronounce his name. I don't quite know. I apologize. And most Americans are financially concerned, yet have no concerns about just throwing $200 away here and there, flushing money down the toilet on anything from slots to sports to cryptocurrency to betting on mayor elections. And this is the world in which we live, and it's the world in which we live is described by many people as a decadent sort of society. And in a decadent society, money, pursuits, interests, work, everything is kind of treated as trivial, as unimportant, as if you do your thing, I do my thing. What is life all about? And it's easy for Christians to kind of just say, yeah, we live a very trivial life too. Going from one amusement to the next. See, you see, one person gets amused by throwing $200 out on a mayor election. Another does by gaming all day long. One person gets amused by watching Netflix nonstop. Another by scrolling through Instagram or TikTok nonstop. Even our politics today, for many people, is a sport by which you just yell at the TV, yell about the other side, and even maybe bet a little here and there on the outcomes, without requisite consideration of the needs or concerns of others, or even trying to talk to people on the other side of the aisle. And all of this is the water in which we swim. And I think that oftentimes we kind of just think that's okay. It's comfortable. I'm not too concerned about it. Things aren't that broken. It doesn't eat at us in a way that's perhaps appropriate for people that really feel deeply that perhaps our world is actually teaching us to prostitute ourselves off against God. You see, Revelation calls idolatry adultery on a few occasions, and whether it's money, power, or sex, or just being comfortable, most of us place these things on such a pedestal we're unwilling to call into question the ridiculousness of much of our society and our American life. And what I want to just remind us as we read this book, as much as we can talk about the future and all of that, it's possible right now you're kind of comfortable doing business with the harlot. And if you are following the metaphor, I'm trying to call us to constantly call into question whether we are making peace with this broken world when we should, in fact, be actively resisting it. And for the strength to actively resist the way our world works, I want to give us two images that invite. First, I want to talk about true riches as a gift. And I'm going to reread what I've already read again from Laodicea.
Images that invite true riches as a gift. Jesus addresses the church at Laodicea, again directly after calling the poor naked, and hear what he says. Revelation 3:18, I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire so you can become rich, and white clothes to wear so you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put on your eyes so you can see. Now, obviously Jesus will elsewhere emphasize that you cannot actually buy this. He's trying to drive home the point that he's the only one where you can get this stuff from. You can't go to any other merchant and find it there. And it's ironic, of course, that Jesus is flipping it yet again, the idea that if you want the sort of clothing you need to actually put on the white garments that I have to offer. Again, emphasizing not purity, but royalty. The white robes are the sorts of things that senators and even Caesar would wear. And if you want to actually be rich, don't rely on gold that hasn't been tested in any way, but rely on the gold that will make it till the end, the stuff that has been tested by the fires of Christ. And if you want true treasures, go to the one who offers to give you treasures in heaven, which do not rust or corrupt, as Jesus taught in his life in Matthew chapter 6. Jesus is offering freely the riches that we want and that we need. The white clothes that he promises contrast to that black one and says, come on, stop putting so much trust in all these things and trust what I alone can give. And you see, in a world, it's easy for us to be like, oh man, you know, I want that black wool clothing. I know you don't want black wool clothing because that's just not in style these days. But it's easy to walk around and see someone driving a new Tesla, or even walking around in the middle of the day not doing anything and wondering, how do they do this? And do they have a job? How do they actually make money? And wishing that you had that person's life. And looking at someone who has a beautiful house and Winnetka, Wilmette, or even east of Sheridan, and saying, I would like to have that thing. And to wish that we had that kind of wealth, that kind of rich, those kinds of riches. It's easy to covet, as it were. And Jesus is saying, forget all those riches. I got something better for you. Anything that this world has to offer, it won't actually make you happy. That Tesla will break down, so will that smartphone. Everything that you've put your confidence in will fall apart unless it's eternal riches. And the end of Revelation stresses these riches that are ours in incredible fashion. That goes back to my sermon 3 weeks ago, and it describes a city that is adorned in this way. Again, Revelation 21, 19 through 21. It says the foundations, again, I drive home this point, the foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth ruby, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth turquoise, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate made of a single pearl. The great street of the city was of gold, as pure as transparent glass. You cannot conceive of, you cannot imagine, you cannot actually capture in picture or detail the wonder of the city that is ours if we believe in Christ. And what this does when you believe in the city, in these riches, is it, as that song says, as I said a few weeks ago, it makes the promises of earth go strangely dim. As much as the earthly Jerusalem back in its day, or even the earthly Rome, the earthly London, New York, or Hong Kong of today, invites us to say, I want that. The heavenly city says, I already have that. Everything else cannot bring me anything compared to what is mine. And all that is a gift of Christ. It will not be gained through efforts, through energies, through any expansion. It is simply yours by believing that Jesus Christ died on the cross for your sins and rose from the dead to make a city for you that will be happily yours forever. And I know that that's easy for us to say. It's easy for us to get up here and preach. We talk about this kind of thing all the time at Agape, that we need to let the things that we want so bad not control us in the light. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult for most of us, especially living in our affluent times, not to say, well, I wish I had something like that. Robert Putnam, he's a sociologist, wrote a book called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, about the hollowing out of America's middle class. And one of the incidental points of his book was that for a lot of people, upward mobility that, you know, was taken for granted in the 60s or 70s or 80s seems to be an impossibility for so many people, even on the lower middle classes. And he also pointed out that the sheer frequency of people encountering those that have so much more than them, or even just a little bit more than them, makes people feel deeply how much they lack in a way that's kind of sociologically odd and hard for them to explain, but just a simple fact of American life. And again, in the United States, we are tempted to feel our loss more acutely, even though we are, historically speaking, rather wealthy, because we have so many people around us that are doing just a little bit better than we are. Now, I do think wealth is one of those things that is summarized well by John D. Rockefeller's famous response to the question, how much money is enough? And what did he say? Just a little bit more. And the true riches Revelation offers us is more than we could possibly imagine, think, or hope. And it repeatedly tells us that by inviting people like the church in Laodicea to receive true wealth instead of striving for fake wealth, that Christ is going to ultimately conquer for us in the end. And it frees us to be the sort of people that can actually be generous, that can be kind, that don't have to always hold their fist, hold their money in the right fist with tight clenched fist, because we believe that God is going to provide. God will take care of us now, and He will take care of us in the future. So we are able to detach ourselves from the love of money and the love of all that it can provide us, whether that's success, whether that's comfort, whether that's safety, security, whatever we're seeking from it. Last, and this is the image that I hope, if any of the images that I want you to keep from a day stick, I really want to be this one. I could have said it in different ways, but this is the way we said it before. Sharing Jesus' victory. Sharing Jesus' victory, or sitting with Him on His throne, however you want to express that. Revelation, at the end of the day, from beginning to end, has been a book not simply that tells us that Jesus wins, but that He wants you to win with Him. That He is going to prove victorious, and He wants you to share that victory. Like being that, let's just say the Bears win the Super Bowl this year. Can we hope for a little bit? Can we hope? There's a 53rd guy on the roster who's getting paid like $200,000, which is really nice to be the 53rd guy on the football roster, but he's not getting any playing time, and he's just there for practice. He gets a Super Bowl ring if they win. And he doesn't do anything, he doesn't make a tackle, he doesn't do anything. What the whole Bible tells us is that if you're on Jesus' side, you are that 53rd man, or 53rd woman, as it were. And you get to share His victory. And after addressing the church in Laodicea, again, Jesus uses language that I think most evangelical Christians are a little unsure what to do with. What does this mean? And he says things like this often in Revelation. To the one who is victorious, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I was victorious and sat down with my Father on His throne. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. What does it mean to be victorious in the book of Revelation? It means to endure to the end, to be a faithful witness of Christ till the end. The one who actually wins and prevails against all that life brings at them, whether it's comfort or oppression, whether it's ease or difficulty, they are the ones who are going to sit with Christ on the throne. And Jesus again tells the same another church something similar in Revelation chapter 2. He says, to the one who is victorious and does my will to the end, I will give authority over the nations. In our lifetime, victory may mean rejecting a ruthless dictator. But it also might just mean that you're refusing to be comfortable until you pass away at the age of 88 or whatever. It might be refusing to let the comforts, the pleasures, the casinification of America numb us from the ultimate goal of our lives, namely to make Christ known, to invite people to feast on the love of Jesus, and while Chicago to feast on the love of Jesus, for us to feast on the love. You see, for us, those that are comfortable, perhaps comfortably uncomfortable. Those that recognize that we shouldn't be so comfortable in this world, but we are, and we don't always know what to do with it. Revelation 21:22 gives us a beautiful vision of an eternal paradise that is ours. And this vision isn't simply us hanging out in Hawaii and you know, enjoying pina coladas all day long, but it's rather being restored to our initial location to rule and care for God's planet well, with Christ, under Christ. And what about those who feel a great deal of victory right now, a great deal of luxury right now? Their jobs are good, have a good house, everything is going okay, you're winning, people like you, you're respected at work. You're the sort of person who's already victorious. What I want to caution you about is the possibility that the victory of Christ doesn't sound as good to you as it should because you're doing so well on your own. We feel control, so it feels, why give up control to Christ? And the book of Revelation is insisting there's danger there, there's danger there. And in fact, there's more danger there than there is in facing the Antichrist and his guillotine or whatever else he's going to use. The danger of losing your soul is much more dangerous than the danger of losing your life. And the person that doesn't realize the mirage that they have control, that they are able through technique or skill managing their lives, is great indeed. Many of us claim Jesus as King and we say, you're worthy of it all, but how much do we really give to him? How much do his commands actually sit in our mind when we are making decisions right or left and influences us to do the thing that we know that he wants? In one respect, we can hear the book of Revelation about some other time or place, not about 21st century Christians that are comfortable waiting for the apocalypse or not under Nero in Rome. But what I want us to understand is that in the 21st century, we in the United States, we have a unique opportunity. We have a unique opportunity to say we will trust Christ's victory even when we can have all sorts of victories on our own today. In the history of the church, a lot of times it's either death, difficulty, or the victory of Christ. For us, it's our victory or Christ's victory. And I want to ask you, whether or not you're living in a Brave New World or 1984, if Jesus were to come back in your lifetime, would he be able to say to you that you've been trusting him for his victory rather than the small entertainments, pleasures, and tedium that this world offers us? We invite Chicago to feast on the love of Jesus as victorious people, but victorious in Christ. The degree to which we are comfortable in our own victories, we are going to be less effective in that invitation because we won't really realize how desperate everybody is for it. So don't be tempted by the promises of this world. Revelation is challenging us. Remember that true riches come from Christ. True victory comes from Christ. And that's going to be what helps us to resist the wealth that leads to poverty and even engaging in a prostitute. Let those images and other images stick in your mind, for that's how Revelation is intended to work. You might remember Bible passages and stories from Jesus from the Gospels, but the images of Revelation should drive home some central points in your mind and move you forward to honoring him as we move along, trying to honor Christ until we see him one day. Let's pray.